He just said something along these lines. It's important to distinguish between the thinking mind and the aware mind. And I was like, it was like, slap me around the head, right? I hadn't even, because aware, the aware mind, awareness, whatever you want to call it, it's so subtle. What's that quote? Something like, it's the greatest secret and the most obvious treasure or something like that, from Kashmir Shaivism. And but it just slapped me around the face. This, I was like, how have I missed that?
Simon, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast because, you know, when you find people who are on the similar wavelength, it's such a beautiful thing. And so just from reading your stuff, just from listening to your podcast with Peter Krohn, I know we are on the same place and same page. So thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I couldn't agree more. We hopped on this call and immediately just started riffing and chatting. And it was very clear that we are already connected prior to even meeting. So I really appreciate all your work as well. As I said, you put out a tweet today about not resisting that I just loved. I thought it was only about five words, but it was perfect. So Danny, I'm privileged, I'm honored, and it's just lovely to talk to you.
Yeah, I think the tweet was, what if you lived without resistance?
Such a good tweet.
Like, why did that hit you so deeply?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. So without going into too much detail, I'm personally at a period of, you know, a bit of a fork in the road moment with my book coming out and everything like that, which has obviously been my big focus. But as well, so is my wife. And she had something happen that caused an immense amount of resistance initially. And her first Substack post of the year was about a year of surrender. All right. And so she got this news. She was quite upset, which was fine. Like, you know, an emotional reaction is fine. And then in time, I said to her, look, this is going to be your year of surrender. And so she then wrote another Substack post about this. This is my first opportunity to try this. And so she dropped resistance. A day later, she was like, I feel completely different about this. And to me, that she actually said, I'm like Eckhart Tolle now. We had a bit of a laugh about that. And it just shows, you know, the resistance caused this immense suffering in the first instance. She dropped it and it was literally like her experience was utterly transformed. So, yeah, when you put that, I thought that was very profound because so much suffering is caused by resisting what is.
Yeah, it's really powerful that your wife was able to drop it within one day. And what I've often found is that people, like my friends have commented to me a similar thing. Like they're amazed that they could just tell me something in one moment. And then in the next, I'm just, yeah, like I don't need that belief anymore. So thank you for pointing that out. And what do you think causes people to be able to drop it quickly versus it prolonging?
That's a good question. I think it's a willingness and an openness to see the resistance in action in the first place. Because I think a lot of the time we don't even know. We assume that the way we feel is caused by external events or, you know, as Peter Krohn often says, right? I know he's been on your pod as well, is that life will show you where you're not free. And so if you realign and realize that it's not external events that are causing how you feel, and then you can investigate the feeling. So when then the feeling shows up, so for me in the past, for example, I've had feelings of shame or insecurity. For a long time, I hated feeling them. You know, it was about getting rid of them. Now it's like when they show up, it's like, okay, no, this is good. This is information. This shows me this is where I need to go. So I think just having that awareness that it's all happening inside, nothing's personal, that nothing's personal coming from the outside in, and then being willing to be with and step into those uncomfortable feelings. And I think that's hard because culturally we tend not to think that way. We tend not to approach life in that way.
Yeah. I mean, I was scrolling back on your Instagram and the things you post today are about freedom and, you know, a lot about sports as well. But, you know, you have earlier in your past, it's like random photos from different situations. And I was like, I'm so curious when it shifted for this man and when he started to see life in a more clear way.
Oh, I love that question. So I would say my journey, for want of a better word, was triggered by suffering, which I think it is almost without exception. I'm always slightly skeptical when people say it's not about suffering. I actually think there has to be something in that. Otherwise, like, why search, you know? Mm. And so I had various things that, as I said, I felt insecure about, some anxiety, some family of origin, disgruntlements, all the usual stuff. But I was fortunate, I suppose, in that I didn't have too much suffering that it incapacitated me. I had just enough that I wanted to do something about it, but not too much that I was laid low. So I went off on a big quest, and it started off with sort of self-improvement and stuff like that, all the usual stuff. And I was actually quite a strong, what's the word, atheist. So there was a guy I really liked called Christopher Hitchens. And I liked him because he was just such a brilliant orator, such a great speaker, very eloquent. And I remember I went on a date with someone in 2013 and was sort of talking about this. And this girl sort of challenged me on that. And then she introduced me to something called inner bonding with a woman called Dr. Margaret Paul, who lives in Colorado, I think. And I sort of, it was a kind of inner child related stuff. Anyway, I got into that and I had a couple of really mad experiences that were just like slaps around the face. Some people call them like God slaps, right? And then as well, I was having problems with relationships. They were just the same pattern was happening again and again and again. And I eventually sort of saw it wasn't, the only one common denominator was me, not them, right?
So just for like, oh. Just for curiosity, what was the pattern?
Okay, the pattern was I'd meet someone and I would fall quickly, and they perhaps wouldn't be that into me to start, and then over time perhaps they would start to get into me, and once it became, let's say, close and intimate and stuff like that, I think then my feelings of engulfment and fears of intimacy got triggered, and then my mind would come up with a reason why I should leave. Mm-hmm. And that just happened again and again and again until I sort of examined it and realized, you know, the mind was just coming up with excuses. It was actually this deeper fear that was at play. And so I remember being in my bedroom, and again, I can't really explain what happened, but I remember being there and just having this really clear intuition that I was being like guided. And I remember in my room on my own, I was like, okay, I'll do whatever. And that led me on various paths. I met a guy who introduced me to, this is an exclusive, psychedelics. And I went and I did ayahuasca in 2015, and that definitely really made it very clear to me that things were not as they seemed. And yeah, you know, I'd read some Eckhart Tolle, which I think is a gateway drug for a lot of people. That was in about 2013 as well. So it was around that time. And then from that point, you know, it's just been my hyper focus ever since, and sort of the understanding, you know, I got diagnosed with ADHD last year, and you know, that hyper-focused side of me used to be on tennis was my thing. Presence, you know, Eckhart Tolle talks about that. It's like, why do people like watching tennis? Because it's you're watching presence. And that was very true for me. Roger Federer, right? It's beauty. But that focus has now shifted onto non-duality, awareness, spirituality, whatever you want to call it, all loaded terms. And so I just can't get off it now. I wouldn't want to get off it now. I think to me, actually, I would say that the self-development path, in my view, inevitably leads to the spiritual path. It has to. That's just my opinion. I'm not saying that as a truth, but that's my view. And so I couldn't possibly envisage a situation where I come off it, because it just has deepened for me over time. It's given me a lot more peace. It's given me a lot more empathy. It's given me a lot more meaning, purpose, connection with people like you, you know, where it's just bang, straight in. I've got so many like that. So yeah, that's the story, I would say.
So beautiful. And I'm curious, what was it like when you're transitioning? So you're part commentating, you're in the tennis world, and you're part in the spiritual world. And how do those two intersect, and what's going on in that dynamic when it's shifting?
That's funny. So I was a news reporter for the BBC first, and then I got into sport, and it was a good time because we had a home Olympics, Andy Murray won Wimbledon and stuff like that. But, you know, I've never been a stereotypical sports reporter, as we call it over here, sports broadcaster, because like, I don't support a football team. And for a while, I felt like a bit of an imposter, a bit of a fraud. You know, I would sometimes, even very early on in my career, pretend that I did support a football team just so that it was like I wouldn't be found out. And then,
wait, could you just break that down? Like, what? I don't understand exactly.
Okay, so football here, soccer, mm-hmm. is like, you know, by far the national number one sport, and it's very it's almost unheard of for a sports reporter not to support a team, to have a team, you know. So my best friend supports Chelsea, or someone else will support Tottenham, and these emails sort of go around going, oh, he's a Chelsea fan, but don't hold it against him, you know. It's sort of office banter, office conversation, all that stuff. So it's identity stuff, right? And so I wanted to fit in, so I pretended. And then I suppose about the time I've spoken about with that transition, I realized that was stupid. And so I started to really own that I didn't support a football team, and really in many ways was not a stereotypical sports reporter, but still felt that there's that saying, sport is a metaphor for life. And so I wanted to explore that. But I remember actually going to a mind, body, spirit festival in about 10 years ago, and speaking to a guy called Robert Holden, who is a really nice guy. He does a lot of work around the Course in Miracles. And I remember asking about this. I was like, I'm doing sport now, but I really, the spiritual is where my real passion is. You know, how can I make that transition? And he just said, follow your heart. That's always worked for me. And at no point at that, certainly it wasn't clear how I could make that transition at that point. But by just sort of taking a few risks, owning the way I was with sport, that I wasn't a football fan, that I thought the way it was covered was quite superficial and quite focused on results and tactics and just stuff that didn't really show some of the beauty of sport in terms of what it can teach us about life. When I started doing that, opportunities just started opening up. My podcast came, then I got approached about writing the book, and then the book evolved into, I couldn't not weave together sport and spirituality, because I actually think they are really, I can perhaps explain in a bit, I don't want to just keep riffing on this one answer, but I think sport is a really good way actually of illustrating some spiritual truths. And yeah, that's pretty much it. But it was funny. It just happened. The transition just happened, as with life, right? You just go with the flow.
Isn't that such a beautiful thing, how it just happens, spontaneously arises, and it's only about your ability to witness it unfold that will either cause you suffering or cause you joy. Break down for me the connection between sport and spirituality.
Okay. So what I would say is this, is that culturally, I think this is true in the States and here in the UK in particular, there is this idea that we will feel happy, fulfilled, content when X happens. And by X, I mean success. Now, that could be, for example, getting the job, the promotion, the relationship, the house, the bank balance. In sport, you know, the trophy, the World Cup win, the Olympic gold medal. But there are so many examples of people who've got to the top of their proverbial Everest, and it's left them feeling really unfulfilled and empty. And so success is not synonymous with happiness and fulfillment. But then if you look at the experience of flow, which is what we love about sport, like, as I mentioned, Roger Federer, like, watching Roger Federer in flow is, it's poetry in motion, it's art, like, touches something really deep inside me. And so flow, both in terms of witnessing it, but also being in it, is inherently enjoyable. Now, why is it inherently enjoyable? Well, I would argue it's for the following reason. First of all, time distorts. So time can, you know, we can get into time later. But perhaps more important is our sense of self disappears, because thoughts about past go, thoughts about future go. And if you, without thoughts about past and future, the self concept, as I call it, the ego, whatever you want to call it, it can't stand, because it lives in time, as you know. And so it goes, and we love it. We love it when that happens, right? And there are, sport is such an obvious portal into that. If you look at from extreme sports down to, like I said, a Federer, Djokovic, Nadal type thing. And there are lots of portals like that into flow, whether it be cooking, conversation, art, drama. It's all the same stuff. It just happens. Sport just happens to be a good illustration of it. And so, you know, we tend to think, oh, it's the success, but that isn't often the case. But flow always is enjoyable. And so the fact that that coincides with our sense of self being absent suggests that we love it when our sense of self is absent. And if it can be absent, that means how real is it anyway? Something that comes and goes can't be definitively who we are. And so I argue that, you know, in those moments when the sense of self goes in flow, the background aware presence that is our fundamental identity just shines. And it is inherently joyful and fulfilled, all those things. And then we assume that it's caused by the sport or the trophy or the cooking or whatever, right? And you could argue in some ways it is, because it facilitates that thing. It helps it happen, but it's not. All it's doing is revealing what's already there, you know, the peace that we always want. And so, yeah, that to me is how I would suggest sport illustrates the sort of spiritual truths, that the perennial philosophy, whatever you want to call it, you know, the things that everyone points to, the lack of resistance that you said in the tweet, right? Like when you're in flow, there's no resistance. You are totally in sync with the moment, and we love it.
So beautifully illustrated. And so the question becomes then, for someone listening, how do you feel that state more?
Yes. So what I think, first of all, is just to explore the implications of that, as I've said. So it's like a lot of people think, okay, well then how do I get in flow more? And obviously that's, you know, that's something nice to consider, and we all have different ways with our, you know, respective conditioning and body mind that, you know, what works for me might not work for you, and so on and so forth. But actually I think if we recognize that, again, this the ego, the self-concept, who we think we are, can go, and we love it, then we can start questioning this idea of ourselves in the first place, that the self that kind of gets in the way, right? And so once we do that, then we can self-inquiry. I've got a bit of self-inquiry in the book, a process where, you know, you're saying, hang on, am I my thoughts? Well, I can't be my thoughts because I'm aware of my thoughts. Am I my feelings? No, I can't be that because I'm aware of my feelings. Anything I'm aware of, I cannot be. So what's left? And the only thing that is left is aware presence, awareness, the aware mind. You know, these are all words, right? But it's subtle. A friend of mine, a guy called Piers Thurston, has got a lovely way of expressing it. It goes from being invisible to subtle to obvious. This kind of awareness that it can hear my voice now, that is aware of the sensations of my feet, it is the one ever-present element of all experience. And the more you notice that, the more you become aware of awareness, the more, in my experience, it rises from the background to the foreground of experience. Now, that's not to say that the ego or the small self or the separate self or whatever goes, because, you know, I would never claim, in my case, that to be, you know, the case. I'm often lost still in that small ego self, right? But it's a sort of transition, an evolve. I notice that this, as I said, this background awareness that is actually not background, right? It's the substance of everything, right? You notice that it just becomes more and more obvious. And I love that deepening of that there, yes, just being able to sort of tap into that far more frequently. And so, sorry, to come back to your initial question, it is just to notice, okay, if I can be aware of my thoughts, that means I can't be my thoughts. So what is it that's aware of my thoughts? You can't grasp it with your mind. It's a prior to your mind. So you can only be it. And so it's so subtle. But the more that you are, be it, rest as it, the more kind of obvious it becomes, but not in a conceptual way. And then the beautiful thing I would say on top of that, right, is the peace it gives you and stuff like that, the meaning. But I also would say for me, actually, the biggest implication of this is that it gives you kind of confidence and humility, because on that level, we're all the same. We're not better or worse than anyone else, which then gives you sort of compassion and empathy, but without having to try. So, you know, I sometimes try and avoid quoting Jesus, and I'm not even sure I'm going to quote him right, but you know, he said, didn't he, love thy neighbor like thyself. And that's not like do that because it's the right thing to do, because you know that's it, it's more like no, recognize that on that level you are the same. And so it's a recognition that I don't think takes much work. Just the more you recognize it, the more actually it seeps into how you feel, but also how you behave towards other people. And that's been my experience, that I'm definitely more empathetic, kinder, forgiving, all those things without effort. The recognition does all that for you. That's the cool thing.
The confidence and humility piece is so true. And I think we're naturally attracted to people who are operating without ego or operating without the self, because they're operating with love and kindness in their heart while also not being cocky about it, right? They're being confident about it. It's a completely different energy. And that comes as a result of you dropping the ego. You drop the small self to go into the bigger self. Yeah. You know, you talk about the importance of being and doing. And I was doing research for this, and I found a post you wrote, I believe last year. And I was like, this is crazy, because I'm on the phone with my friend yesterday about the importance of being versus doing. And we had a whole 30-minute conversation about this. And of course, it's right here in the post you wrote a year ago. So let me read a bit from it, and you could comment on it in the most interesting bits. The importance of being instead of doing. Most people are continually in doing mode. The goal-setting mind keeps us busy, whether it be sending emails, tidying up, scrolling through social media, doing a HIIT workout. We are conditioned to believe that doing will eventually bring happiness and fulfillment, but it is an endless state of becoming. Being is about accepting and allowing. There's no goal to reach for a change. It's just being with whatever is present in our experience here and now. It is about relating to both our internal and external experience differently. Even thoughts about doing are just objects appearing in awareness. You don't need to do anything with them, neither cling to them nor push them away. Just notice them.
Shit.
Yeah. I wrote that. That's good. I forgot.
Someone wrote that, yeah, and we are now the conscious experience experiencing it again.
There we go. That's it. Yeah, I think my comment on that would be, it's an interesting time of year. So we're in January, which means that in all the newspapers here in the UK, they do the, right here, do this year to be happy or have a great 2024, that kind of thing. And they're always doing stuff, you know, things like, look, when you brush your teeth, stand on one leg, or you know, there are just millions of them. No one ever talks about the being side of things. And so actually, I quite like what I said to you earlier, sorry, I couldn't remember if it was before we started recording, about my wife, that surrender, that being, that getting in sync with how things are. And another thing from a point of the doing, I mentioned scrolling in that post, you know, that's such a pandemic of behavior. And so actually I was up in town today, I was up in London, so I had to get the train up there for a meeting about doing a talk. And so I love going on trains or buses, because I just sit and I just sit sometimes with my eyes shut and just notice it's all appearing in this one field, and sometimes I might follow my breath a bit or just look at stuff. And I just, yeah, I really love that, you know. I just think that people tend to feel guilty when they're not doing. But I mean, to come back to sport, right? People here work, not in sport, but people here work normally 8-hour days. If you work in sport, or if you're an athlete, you train for 3 hours and the rest of the time is resting, just being. And so not only is it about when we embrace being, we sort of sense that aliveness and that awareness that we are, but also it helps us function better. So I just think, yeah, my advice to anyone is just embrace boredom and just find times to just be, you know. And for me, public transport or queues or stuff like that are just gilt-edged opportunities to just be. And it's amazing what you can recognize about our natural state when you be. You know, try turning your awareness off when you be.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think we can... Do you think we'll ever get to the point where being will be more normal in our society than doing?
I'm optimistic about this. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm glad I can see you nodding. So I hope you are too. And some people say, I remember actually, I watched a video with Bernardo Kastrup yesterday and he was asked this question and he said, he's in the middle. It's either like it's going to be the end of humanity or we're going to flourish. Mm-hmm. I'm on the flourishing side because I just think that, you know, as I said 10 years ago I was nowhere near this, 11 years ago I was nowhere near this understanding, recognition, path. And since doing my podcast and introducing this idea through conversations I had, you know, on the BBC and the first time, so many people have come up and I've connected with people just like you and I have today, right? And I think when people are on this path, the connection is just bang, like immediate, right? And I've just noticed so many people. Now, Eckhart Tolle talks a bit about this, is that, you know, you've got the two polarities. So right now we've got a lot of noisy people making a lot of noise and it's being amplified by things like social media. But I think in the middle, you've got a lot of people who... It's a bit cliche, but let's just say are starting to wake up. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that in terms of, oh, the Matrix is trying to do us over. None of that stuff. I'm just talking about recognizing what we're talking about, like that we're not this idea of ourselves, you know, nothing more conspiracy theory than that. And so there's that. I think just the sheer, the number of conversations I have about this on my YouTube channel, it's funny, like when I put the big sporting names up, people aren't nearly as interested as when I talk about this kind of stuff. And that's to me a really positive sign. And then on top of that, then you've got the scientific angle. So you've got people like Bernardo Kastrup, who's got his book, Why Materialism is Baloney. People like him, really, from the Essentia Foundation, talking about idealism, which is non-duality, essentially. Professor Donald Hoffman, talking about, you know, space-time is over. The Nobel Prize last year was given to two people who proved that local realism is false, i.e. things do not have, you know, position, momentum, all those things without an observer, which points this thing. And Donald Hoffman told me something very interesting about that, which was that when Einstein got his Nobel Prize in 1922, people remember it as being for the theory of relativity. Now, I don't, by the way, claim to be some physics genius, because I'm not. But actually, what he told me was, Donald Hoffman, was that no, the Nobel Prize committee made it very clear it wasn't about relativity. It took another 10, 20 years for that to become that thing that he had pointed out to sort of seep into the mainstream. And then everyone's like, okay, Einstein's theory of relativity, black holes, et cetera, et cetera. So my sense is very few people know about this Nobel Prize. Actually, I think it was 2022. But in another 10, 15, 20 years, my hunch is that that will become a lot more obvious. And then, as Donald Hoffman says, He says you just got to wait for the old guard to die off. So the old physicists to die off with the old paradigm, because the young guys, he said a lovely quote, that they're having a ball outside space-time, right? They're finding structures outside space-time. And so he said all it takes is one killer app or something like that, and bang. So the way I look at it is, to sum up, we used to think it was obvious the sun went around the earth. It was obvious the earth was flat. You know, our perceptions mislead us. So, but with the shift that I notice happening in with people who I speak to, and then some of these other things, eventually they've got to cross over into, in my view, the mainstream. And I think, you know, we criticize social media because it has got some negatives, but everything's like negative and positive. But these ideas spread a lot quicker as a result. YouTube, stuff like that. So, yeah, I think the appetite's there, and I think we're moving in that direction. So I'm optimistic. How about you?
Yeah, I'm optimistic as well. The reason I asked the question was because in the past 2 hours, I had somebody, two different entrepreneurs in their late 20s, early 30s, worth over $10 million. Both. One said to me, I'm inspired by the way you love, and I'm going to make the map of consciousness from David Hawkins my phone background. And so that was one, like, because he saw that I had my phone background was David Hawkins' map of consciousness. And he was like, I need to do that too. So I was like, that's incredible. And another, a $10 million entrepreneur telling me, I loved your piece about coming to God. Where do I start with Peter Crone? And so, like, well, something is happening.
Yeah, sure.
And like, these are two very separate but powerful people in their own worlds, very capable, intelligent. And it's like, okay, what's the ripple effect of those two people waking up? What's the ripple effect? You know, like, and so I just start thinking and I'm like, wow, the fact that these people trust me, and I'm sure you get this in your own world of sport as well. It's like, this is really cool. And I'm just grateful to observe the whole process unfold.
Yeah. Yeah. Completely agree. I've got a comment and then a question, if that's all right for you, Danny.
Please.
First of all, I think also it's quite interesting that there's a lot of people now on the world stage who quite obviously have very inflated egos, right? And I don't, to me, in a way, that's not a coincidence. It's like things sort of get bigger before they collapse, right? So that's one idea. But then, so that was just an idea I wanted to throw out there. But okay. I've noticed that you talk about David Hawkins a lot and his map of consciousness and stuff. Would you say his books your favorite books of this genre?
So I can just see how my own consciousness has increased in the past month from really diving into it. I've been aware of his work in the map for maybe 2 years, 3 years, something like that, but really applying all of this stuff and muscle testing has led me to a new level of understanding about myself and the world around me that's allowed me to operate in a feeling of unconditional love. Right, that's cool. I never have experienced. I couldn't tell you I experienced that a month ago.
Right. Wow. That's awesome.
So
I'm going to dive back into his books then. Which is your favorite of his?
I found Power versus Force, which is the one that people they typically recommend. I found that too intellectual for me. I couldn't really grasp the concepts in a way that maps of consciousness really allowed me to. So that's the one that I'm going to start recommending to people, maps of consciousness.
Maps of consciousness. Okay, cool. Yeah, I've got Power v Force. What's his other one, the yellow one?
Letting Go. I have
letting
that
go.
One.
Yeah.
I have that one looking at me right now, and I'm like, that's the next one for me to read.
Right.
But
Maps of consciousness. I'm going to order that once we finish this. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I think that... And he said in the book, this is the crazy part, that the mere recognition of understanding the chart increases your consciousness by 35 points.
Wow.
And I found that exactly to be true. And then after that, I started to calibrate words and phrases that we use, and that increased my consciousness by 25 points.
Wow.
And I'm tracking it day by day. And I have no attachment to any of the results that come out, and I'm completely content with anything. And it is just, and I find the things that used to trigger me are just like water over the bridge. And I'm able to love the person that I was once triggered by and love the situation I was once triggered by. So I'm in awe. And I really can't recommend David Hawkins' work enough. And I really just need to figure out the best way to talk about it in a way that people can understand and calibrate with. And because I feel like this is crazy, man. Like, this is what I would have said to myself if I'm listening to myself 2 years ago. So how do I, and so that's what I'm kind of curious to know your perspective on. How do you best package some of this stuff when it is so esoteric for so many?
Yeah, that's the key conundrum, I think, because I'm quite lucky in that I've been talking to my wife about it for years. And, you know, she calls me out as someone who can be long-winded and go around the houses. And then when I've written my book, where I get into this in the last few chapters in particular, as I've told you, in terms of through flow and stuff, and, you know, I realized I had to be able to try and explain it simply. So actually, are you aware of acceptance and commitment therapy, ACT?
No.
Okay, so ACT is... So this was actually another important part on my journey. I had quite bad insomnia caused by anxiety in my 20s and, you know, tried everything. And I, by good fortune, found this guy called Dr. Guy Meadows, right? And he said one line that I swear is like the most important line I've ever heard. So I went in to see this guy, and he's got this flourishing, it's called the Sleep School now, flourishing company here in the UK. And he said, he just said something along these lines. It's important to distinguish between the thinking mind and the aware mind. And I was like, it was like, slap me around the head, right? I hadn't even, because awareness, whatever you want to call it, it's so subtle. What's that quote? Something like, it's the greatest secret and the most obvious treasure, or something like that, from Kashmir Shaivism. But it just slapped me around the face. This, I was like, how have I missed that? So I come back to that quite a lot, in that I try and make this distinction between, okay, you've got the thinking mind and the aware mind. So you've got the thinking mind is obviously we're all familiar with that. It conceptualizes, it judges, it labels, it basically adds subtitles to reality, you know, continually. And we're all very familiar with that. And we tend to get lost in that. We think the voice in our head is who we are. You know, that's where positive thinking and all that stuff kind of comes from. But then if you can notice that, hang on, anytime, that's why mindfulness is quite interesting, because anytime you can just catch yourself or catch a thought going across and you notice it, in that moment, you're not the thought. And you know, and then, or you recognize you're not your thought. Now, you might not realize the implications of that, because we tend to think, oh, there are some thoughts that are us and some thoughts that aren't. But actually, no, it's no, we're none of them. Like, they all just pop up. And this aware mind is, you can't grasp it. You can't grab it. You know, the analogy people often use is like a knife trying to cut a knife, or an eye trying to look for an eye. You can't find it as an object, but you can sense it and you can be it. And it's so hard, because for a long time, you know, I've done self-inquiry, I've done trying to be aware of being aware and that stuff. And the mind, it drives the mind crazy. You know, because as soon as you're there, the mind might pop up and go, oh, that's it. And then as soon as that it does that, then you've lost it, right? And so it's a recognition that you've got to keep letting go. And the more I do that, or the more one does that and comes back to this aware mind, awareness, consciousness, aware presence, whatever you want to call it, the more you sort of make your home there, you become more bedded in, and it, as I said, it sort of seeps into your being, in my experience, more and more and more. So yeah, I think the aware mind and thinking mind, for me, I've tried it on a couple of friends explaining it in that way, and it seems, because you're using terminology that people are familiar with, and perhaps they can notice in their experience, oh yeah, I'm aware of the sounds I can hear. I'm aware of the sensations of my feet. I'm aware of what I can see. Some people still don't get it on that level. But for me, that seems to be the easiest way in, is that distinction, aware mind, thinking mind. And then, you know, you can really drag that out though and go deeper and go, well, it's not just stuck up here in the head as we tend to think of it. It's, you know, look for where awareness starts and ends. You know, you're no more aware of your thoughts in your head, actually, than you are of the sight of the tree across the road. It's all, everything's appearing in awareness. And from an experiential point of view, something I quite like to is I find it easier with my eyes shut, is just to shut my eyes or get someone to shut their eyes and perhaps like notice a sensation of your feet and then notice a sound and ask yourself, are they appearing in a different field or the same field? And are they made of the same of the field or something else? And I think on that level, it's quite obvious. It's just this big field with sort of different vibrations or different, you know, ungraspable, whatever they are, you know, within it, you know, within this big field. I've gone a bit deep there. So, but yeah, the easy way in, thinking mind, aware mind. That's what I would say.
So beautiful. I mean, so much to think about and or so much to be aware about, really.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm curious, like, what's the purpose for being here?
Oh, wow. Like, I'm not sure I can answer that. Well, okay, I'll try. I don't know. On the deepest level, I think it's beyond the human mind. We tend to think we're a lot cleverer than we are, but actually if I look at how dumb my cats are, and I love my cats, but you know, they'll be like, if they go to the toilet, then they'll go off and start scratching the wall to like clean. I'm like, that's the most stupid thing I've ever seen. Like, we're only a bit more intelligent than that. So to think that we can understand the grand plan, if there is one, of consciousness, of the universe, of God, whatever you want to call it, I think is far-fetched. But I quite like this idea of the way I understand it, or the way I try and live it, would be if the awareness, quote unquote, in me is the same as the awareness in you, as the same as everyone else, that means on that level we are the same, and therefore it's about trying to embody that as best you can to you know, be as kind of loving, and I don't mean a pushover loving, but be as empathetic and kind as you can, and understanding and compassionate and forgiving. Realize things are not personal, like nothing's personal. Like the grievances I used to have about my, you know, my parents, the way they treat me, you realize it's nothing to do with me. It was never anything to do with me, right? Nothing's to do with it. Nothing's personal. And then also to try and do what you said, like to live without resistance, to trust life. Now that's a challenge. I remember Rupert Spira saying, you know, you can give yourself to this understanding, and you can say that, like I said with my wife, about surrendering mm-hmm. to how things are, but it can be difficult in practice. But I suppose in time, you know, it perhaps gets somewhat easier, but then life will always, you know, ramp it up and make challenge you. But yeah, I think that would be it. Loving on the outside and letting go to probably on the inside.
And the more you let go, the more you love, which is a fast.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like there's two separate things, is it? It's the same thing, you know. Yeah, it's just another thing I would say, actually, just this would be, you know, we live in a time where identity is so important. People are so caught up in identity, right? Yeah. And I'm reading a lot of Anthony DeMello at the moment. I like his stuff because he's just like, you know, ego comes where we identify I with me, with anything, right? With anything. And so for me, it's that shifting of identity from Simon, you know, man, dad, job, blah, blah, thinks this, believes that. And by the way, I don't completely dismiss that. I think there's a place for that, actually. I don't want to go completely get rid of the individuality and stuff. But also recognizing that at the deepest level, no, that's just an avatar that comes and goes, that is an identity with this aware presence who's experiencing Simon or, you know, Danny or whoever it is. So it's that shifting of identity gradually. Yeah.
So beautiful. What Anthony DeMello are you reading right now?
I've actually got it right here. Awareness.
Of course.
I love his. He was like a preacher, wasn't he? He was a priest, and the way he speaks, I love it. It's very poetic and powerful and challenging, and yeah, really interesting. Love it. But I think that his definition of the ego is just I. He makes that distinction between I and me, and the I identifying with anything. That's when you get into trouble.
So, I first read Awareness in 2019, and I was too turned off by it.
Really?
This is right in the beginning of my journey meditation. And I'm like, why is this dude coming at me? I've built my whole life on this identity thing. Like, what? I don't. And so, because of that, A New Earth spoke to me more because it wasn't as, in my words, then combative. And it wasn't as attacking to the ego that I was so protecting. And so I kid you not, Simon, I ordered it yesterday for the first.
How funny.
And so I was like, let me revisit this, the thing that once triggered me. Let's see what's going on there. And
very funny.
Yeah, of course.
But it's funny you say that. I've got a New Earth. Actually, it might even be here as well. Let me have a quick look. Yes, it's in my pile here, like literally right here. I've got a New Earth that I come back to A New Earth all the time. I thought I'd lost my old copy, so I bought a new copy and then found the old one. So I got two knocking around the house. Always come back to that because it's. I think it dissects the shape shift the ego so well.
Hmm. To me, one of the most impactful lessons from A New Earth was about the pain body that each generation experiences and understanding that you are also part of that pain body and that the things that you're dealing with now really have nothing to do with you, but they've just been passed down.
Yeah.
And that gave me so much peace. For you, what were the things that the pain body that was passed down to you that you had to work through?
Well, first of all, actually, I think that's a really good point. And to come back to, let's say, the meaning, as you said, like, why are we here? I think that's a big part of it is to do our bit to clean stuff up a little bit, right? And for some people, it's denser and some people, it's not as dense. And actually, while we may think, and certainly I would have thought when I was younger, that having a less dense pain body was a good thing. Now I'm grateful for the suffering and stuff because it led me, well, right here to have this conversation, right? I wouldn't have had it otherwise. You know, suffering is such a catalyst for growth. It can obviously also be, you know, a catalyst for implosion. But yeah, so I do think tidying, doing your bit to tidy stuff up. And that's also why I don't like to just focus on the awareness part, because I do think it's the human being. So the being, let's say, is the awareness, the being, and then there's a human, which is me with all my insecurities and shame and patterns and stuff. But the thing is, when you're in touch with that awareness part, when the shame, when whatever comes up, you can hold it and not identify with it, not have to try and get rid of it. Sometimes I still do, okay? You know, like I'm not, by any stretch, I'm not the finished product, and nor will I ever be. I don't claim to be enlightened. But it does give me that ability to, when stuff comes up that previously I was like, I want to get rid of this or I shouldn't be feeling this. It's like, no, it's okay. No, this is good. It's an opportunity to feel stuff. So in terms of my own pain body, yeah. You know, there's been a lot of mental illness, certainly on one side of my family. And so I've seen some difficult things. People suffer pretty badly. And for whatever reason, it's not personal again. I remember, actually, it comes back to your earlier question about my journey. I remember at one time talking to my sister and sort of being like, you know, I was suffering and I had issues with my parents and stuff. And I was like, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. I don't know how, but I'm going to. I just was so driven and I had no idea what the answer was. And I'm, you know, and here we are. you know, I don't, as it's got rid of any resentment towards my parents, because as we said, nothing's personal. And I think that's such a valuable thing to see. But so for me, I had a lot of anxiety. I think the ADHD thing diagnosis actually kind of helped me on that front. I'm glad I didn't get it earlier though, because I think it would have stopped me from doing all the sort of the questing. But yeah, just difficult to put it more in words than that. But yeah, I've definitely done a lot of bringing my patterns to the surface. I think my relationship's been great for that, I have to say. So Eckhart Tolle says that thing of, you know, relationships aren't here to make us happy, they're here to make us conscious. And in my experience, that's true. So I got together with my wife and we had the honeymoon phase, and then the issues started coming out. And so she's, let's say, if you, people who know a bit about attachment theories, she's a bit anxious attachment. I'm probably anxious avoidant, whatever. But, we're like slightly triggered. We used to trigger each other. And it came to a bit of a head quite early in our relationship. And I said, look, I'm not having that kind of relationship. Either we kind of do work together or we, you know, we'll have to separate. And this was early on. My wife at the time was very anti the idea. The idea of, for example, doing therapy was a admission of defeat. Actually, we have a bit of a laugh about this, because it was on holiday and it came to this head as we were leaving this holiday. And we'd had this argument, you know, stupid argument. And we were in the airport and I had this, like, we've got to do the work, right? That was my thing. And she'd gone to a shop and bought a load of sort of pebbles, like as like this sort of memento. So we, like, it was a joke. I was like, look, if we'd have gone the pebbles route, we would have, if that had been the way to make up, like we'd be done now, right? But yeah, we were lucky. I found a therapist, and I didn't realize it, but fortunately he came from a Course in Miracles background. We didn't know this. And we did a bit of work with him together, and then she carried on seeing him for a long time. Or she doesn't anymore, but and so a quite a good thing that I've heard people say is it's like a rocket leaving the Earth's atmosphere. You need a lot of fuel to get out of the atmosphere, but once you're out, you sail. And in my experience with our relationship, that's been the case. So what used to trigger me and what used to trigger her, like, it just does. It was so good because it brought it to the surface. And now it's a tiny fraction of the degree to which we used to trigger each other. Like, just honestly, I was actually reflecting on this earlier. I remember a wedding that we went to where she got a bit jealous, or I'd been away or something. And then I was sensed she was in a mood. So I was like, oh my God, I've got to make sure she's not. And then I got angry and we had an argument. Whereas now we just would never go near that now. It would just be over in a blink. So yeah, I think relationships. Sorry for a long answer, right? You know, I do ramble, but there we go.
Nothing to apologize for, baby. It's all perfect. what were the things that you worked through, or what the therapist worked through, and what were the processes that really helped you evolve?
God, I couldn't even tell you what the processes were. But what I could say is just realizing, I think, taking responsibility for our respective when we get triggered, right? Rather than actually, when we got married, so we had a small wedding and then a wedding party. And at the wedding party, I remember I gave my speech and I gave that saying of, you know, when you point your finger at someone, there's always three pointing back at you. And so it's like taking responsibility for when you're triggered. So if I'm feeling upset or annoyed or whatever it may be, it's, and same for her, it's to recognize that no, that's my stuff. Sometimes there may be some legitimate things that you can say, look, I'm not happy about this, but it's about taking responsibility for your own reactions. And you know, we point stuff out for each other. You know, I had a pattern of like moaning, for example, in the morning. I'd wake up, oh, I'm sore in this, and I trace that back to when I was younger, and I think I got a bit of sympathy when I was a kid for being a bit like that. And she just said, like, why do you do that? Why don't you just stop that? And I was like, yeah, why don't I just stop that? So I just did, like, literally like that. And then, and she had a not hugely dissimilar one. Thankfully, she'd pointed my one out first. So when I pointed out something a bit, she'd get a bit mopey. And I was like, why do you, just, can you just stop that? And she did as well. So yeah, it's cool. Like, we definitely, I think, embrace our relationship as like a, as this largely, it's more challenging with when you've got a baby running around, as a kind of spiritual union, you know. I think that's sort of first and foremost. I mean, we get on well, don't get me wrong, she's funny and, you know, she's, you know, pretty and all that stuff, but that, I think having that commitment to growth together and individually, and having the kind of interest in spiritual stuff is great. And just to quickly say on that, like, she is, I mentioned to you before we started recording, like, she's powerful. Like, she when she meditates, she goes places. Like, she has powers. She's a Reiki, she does Reiki on me, and like, wow, yeah, powerful. So I think she is the more, so Eckhart Tolle talks about this in New Earth, I think it's New Earth, about the masculine being the ego, and like, quite the conceptual mind being the, like, foremost, whereas the feminine principle, which doesn't have to be in a female, but the feminine principle being more intuitive and emotional, and in closer to enlightenment, actually, I think he says. And actually, yeah, from the way she is, not necessarily in terms of like understanding or thinking about it a lot, that's where I go, she's just experiences it in ways that I'm like, I'm so jealous of what you've just experienced. Like, some of the stuff is just wild.
It sounds like an incredible relationship, an incredible way to grow. And it sounds like you mutually support each other, which is such an amazing thing. I'm curious that this all happened in the container of the UK, correct?
Yes.
So a lot of people, what you're talking about is very common in Austin, Texas. And the conversation we're having is very common. Like, you go to any coffee shop and it's like all this. But I assume some people are listening from Austin, Texas, and I assume a lot are listening, the majority, not in Austin, Texas. And their culture or the things surrounding them is not supportive of this type of world, of this, what's going on. And so I'm bringing this to you because I'm curious what you would recommend for people who the soup that they're living in is not the what they would like to live in themselves. So how do they break out of that mentally to create a stronger reality for themselves?
So do you mean in terms of, you know, being able to have conversations or recognize this understanding that we're talking about, this recognition that we're talking about?
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I remember being on a podcast with a couple of people who I've never actually, I know I have, that's not, I tell a lie. I've met one of them in person and another one I've only known through social media. But again, we have that connection because of this shared view of things, which it's so funny how connected you can get so fast, as we've said already. And someone asked this question of all three of us, like, what would you recommend? It's tricky to imagine, you know, if you're stuck in somewhere where this is not able to percolate. But I do think, you know, it helps to have a community, for sure, right? And to meet people and have conversations like this, it's definitely helpful. But I don't think it's like an absolute must. I think, you know, because it's also a very personal journey. It's a very, like, what do they say in Buddhism? You know, if you see Buddha in the street, kill him, right? Like, we the guru is within, right? And so I actually, I remember the answer I gave at that time was actually just start with the power now. I just think the power now is such a good entry point because I think it's accessible. And I think it's profound, but like you can get it quite easy. So I think that's quite simple. And then I would just come back to just notice that the aware mind bit, just notice that you're aware, everything you've ever experienced, could ever experience, have ever experienced, you're aware of it. Like everything, every single aspect of experience is in awareness, right? That might not seem like a big deal, but if you can just notice that and notice that, you know, or maybe like uncouple awareness at least conceptually from everything that you experience and then put it back together, that's the sort of way in. But yeah, look, I mean, there's as well, sorry to add this on, but you know, there are online forums, aren't there? There's just, you know, it's so much easier now to connect with people as we're doing from hundreds of thousands of miles than it was 10, 20 years ago. So I don't think it really matters where you are. There's definitely ways of finding a like-minded community.
Yeah. I guess a better question might be like, did you ever feel alone along this path?
Do you know what? I don't think I did actually, because as I said, it was a girl who I went on a date with introduced me to or challenged my spiritual aversion early on. And so, you know, her and a friend of hers, I was able to talk to. And I think my wife, we got together not long after, as I said, I had my ayahuasca experience. I met some people through that. Actually, and I always had, there's a good friend of mine who's always been quite this way minded as well. And then my wife being open to me talking about this. I mean, I literally spoke about this on our first date, I remember, like, and she was, you know, at first I think just humored me. But in time, it sort of bed in. And then, but then since I started talking on the podcast about it, I never anticipated that, you know, people recognized it, even when it was only being talked about subtly at first. And so I've made so many connections through that, there were only one or two to start, and now it just grows all the time. Like, you know, you and me now, Danny, right? That's another one. There we go, right? It grows all the time.
And the truth is that the deeper you go into it, the more you are connected to everybody and everything. And so if at first you're in the stage of like, no one understands this, no one gets it, which I assume some people listening are like that or feeling that. I've kind of felt that way a little bit in 2019 when I'm stumbling upon some of this writing. You eventually, I feel like, have to get to the understanding of, oh, this is all just me. I'm looking at me everywhere I go. And if that is me, then how would I treat me? I would treat them with love and compassion and kindness, and that is me. And so even if they're not thinking the same way as you, they are you. So it's all good. And that's your community, wherever you are. There you go.
100%. I think that's a really important point, you know, because they talk about the spiritual ego being like one of the last egos, right? Yeah. And if you're sitting there going, well, they're not spiritual, they don't sit this way, well, then that's just ego as well. But if you can come back to that recognition that, yeah, it's all just, that no one is more spiritual than anyone else. You know, it's impossible, right? So, then absolutely that what you just said was spot on.
I'm also curious to ask about children. And you had shared this amazing poem by William Martin, which I'm going to read now. And I'd love your thoughts and perspectives on this poem, as well as children in general, and how that has aided your growth as a human. So, do not ask your children to strive for extraordinary lives. Such striving may seem admirable, but it is the way of foolishness. Help them instead to find the wonder and the marvel of an ordinary life. Show them the joy of tasting tomatoes, apples, and pears. Show them how to cry when pets and people die. Show them the infinite pleasure in the touch of a hand, and make the ordinary come alive for them. The extraordinary will take care of itself. That's a poem by William Martin. So beautiful. You tweeted about it, I believe, or put it on Instagram and or both. And it's just, I was like, yes, yes to that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's spot on, that poem. It really resonates with me because, again, to come back to that sort of success evangelism stuff, it's like we have to achieve this and get up at 5 a.m. and then we'll be okay. But, you know, I've got a 7-month-old daughter, and then we've got a nearly 9-year-old as well. And, you know, I remember when she was a baby and you know, like in both cases with both of our daughters, it's just obvious they're this idea that they couldn't be enough just as they are is absurd. And then, so that doesn't suddenly change at some point. You know, there isn't this like threshold we cross when we get to like 3 or 4 that suddenly that stops being the case. But we do lose sight of that for various reasons, cultural reasons, ego reasons. But I think, and this is why I think awareness and acceptance is so important, is that's still true of all of us. Just, we've just lost sight of that, you know, through the conceptual mind. Having kids is amazing. So it's hard, don't get me wrong. Particularly, it's harder for my wife, man. God, like, take my hat off to her. But like, so with my youngest daughter, Annabelle, at the moment. So she's 8 months old, something like that. Just utterly, just presence. Just pure presence, pure innocence, pure presence. And, you know, no ego, no nothing. And it's just amazing to witness that. And then with our older daughter, Delilah, she is obviously, she's going through the stages now of, like, the first signs of adolescence are starting to show up. But, and she's quite sensitive. I would say, you know, my nervous system's quite sensitive. And so what I quite like is that I feel with her, this gift to be able to share some of the stuff that I perhaps didn't feel was really accommodated when I was growing up. But, you know, like a couple of things we do. One, we've played what I call the feelings game, where we do happy, sad, excited, and worried before bed. And that's cool because it's like getting in touch with how you feel. And then also, like, if she's anxious about stuff, she used to be really shy. First of all, I'm always getting her to say hi to people in shops and stuff like that, right? Like, say thank you to the nice man, thank you to the nice woman. But as well, I teach, you know, when those feelings of anxiety or thoughts come up, instead of people saying, which so often people do, oh, don't think like that, I'm like, I said no, welcome those thoughts, welcome those feelings. And so she's actually done this. She does things like, oh, I have a tea party for my thoughts and feelings. And she's shown it to other people when she's done like dance recitals and stuff. So yeah, it's a real gift. But one other thing I'll just add on the parenting thing is that, like, and Eckhart Tolle talks about this, I think, in A New Earth, is the roles we play, like the role of adult and the role of being a parent, right? And you relate to your child in that, like, I'm the adult and you're the child, and therefore I you know, I'm up here and you're down there. And it's like, of course we know more and I've got to keep her safe and stuff like that. But then once those kind of more functional ways of being are out of the way, it's, if you just relating, just like I talk to her, or I relate to her just as I would relate to you now. Like, you know, perhaps I might talk about slightly different stuff, but that importance of authentic relationship, no matter the age, you know, whether I've got a gran who's 101, whether with my 101 year old gran or my 9 year old little girl, you know, it's same thing, the same energy, that same authentic connection. I think it's vital.
Same presence, right?
Yeah.
Same ability to be with them in the moment. And just what a beautiful thing it is that the next generation has people like you leading it, in the sense of your daughters are going to understand their emotions, welcome their emotions, not want to push them away, push them to the side, think that there's something wrong with them. And how that will serve them throughout the rest of their lives is really just one of the greatest gifts we can give another human being. And also letting them know it's all good. Whatever happens is all good, and whatever you think is all fine, and embracing that and accepting that, oh man, it warms my heart so much to hear the tea party with your daughter's emotions and feelings. Like, come on. Doesn't get me. Come on.
I love that, you know. She was at a dance recital, as I mentioned, and one of her friends was feeling anxious and nervous, and she was like, oh, welcome the thoughts. She was sort of, and she's like, she was 8 or 7 at the time and was doing that. So yeah, like, who knows how it will pan out, who knows what difficulties she'll face, but it's nice to have these conversations. And it comes back to that, I think, having that opportunity to tidy things up a bit, because the more I think you shine light on your own patterns and do the work, let's say, or right on, you know, accepting your shame or whatever it may be, you know, the shadow, you know, then you're not just doing it for yourself, you're doing it for your kids or the next generation as well. And I think that's a real lovely opportunity.
Yeah, as well as every person you interact with now doesn't have to talk to a version of you that's resisting a shadow that was a part of your life.
Yeah.
Because this is the fascinating thing, is people can tell when you're not comfortable with yourself, and it affects how they show up as well. And so if you really sit with that, it's like every interaction that you exist in is more pure, is more present, is more connected because you've dealt with yourself.
Yeah.
There's so much. It's a really profound statement, because it is likely, if you're listening to this podcast, you will have tens of thousands, God willing, hundreds of thousands, millions of more interactions in your lifetime. Can those be more pure? Can those be more present? Can those be more aware? Can those be more the truth of what is happening? AKA, are you the awareness instead of the ego?
100%. You know, it drives my wife crazy, but I love having little interactions throughout the day. If I go into a restaurant, you know, I'm always chatting to the waiter or behind the shop counter or whatever, because even the briefest encounter can be an expression of exactly what you've spoken about. It's all an opportunity to connect on that level of true presence. And so I think a kind of barometer for me of, let's say, spiritual development is the degree to which you can have that same expression of yourself with whoever it is, whether it's someone behind a shop counter or serving you in a restaurant, through to someone who's supposedly a big deal. You know, like I work with, you know, world famous athletes. You know, if I'm coming to them and treating them differently than I would someone behind a shop counter, then that's not right, you know. So I think that's a really valuable thing. And sorry, just one more thing to add. I remember probably, when would this have been? What year are we in now? 2024. So this would have been 12 years ago. I remember being on a stag do, and I was having a jokey argument with a friend of mine. And then he said, we'd had a few drinks and stuff, and he said, "Oh, Mundy, you're insecure." And I tell you what, that stung, right? And I was like kind of cross with him and wanted to lash out. But the reason it stung was because it was true, right? And so, like, whereas now, you know, again, so at that time, I totally resisted that feeling and wanted to change how he was or lash back or hit back. Whereas now, if something triggers me in that way, and there are, you know, still certain people or situations where I can get triggered in that way, then it's an opportunity because it shows you where you're not free, right? And that's
Thank you, Peter Crone.
I mean, that's it, right? That's the journey, I think.
And you're such a beautiful soul on that journey, dude. You warm my heart. Like, the fact that people like you exist, the fact that you show up the way you do, like, it makes me feel so grateful to be able to experience it. So
I can't.
Dude, you're welcome on this podcast anytime you'd like. This hour absolutely flew by. Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. It's out now when you're listening to this. And Life Lessons Podcast with the man himself. Go, those are linked down below, as well as your Twitter and your Instagram. Anywhere else we should send people to connect with you further?
My website, simonmundy.com. Yeah, it's the Life Lessons Podcast. I'm trying to do a bit more LinkedIn. I haven't yet managed to get on top of TikTok, but I keep getting told I've got to do that. But it just seems like hard work. But yeah, any of those platforms, just get in touch. And I always try and reply to anyone who gets in touch with me. I always try and reply. And more often than not, actually, because I don't like typing and texting and stuff, I'll just say, let's get on the phone and chat, and end up talking for hours and making friends that way. And so, yeah, get in touch and I'll get back to you, I promise.
Such a kind soul. Last question is, the purpose of the show is to expand love and freedom in the world. And so someone listening to this wants to expand love and freedom in themselves. What is the first step that they should do right after listening to this podcast?
That's a good question. Accept where they are right now. I think that, yeah, just having that, it's tricky because people say, you know, have compassion for yourself, and you're inserting yourself in there, right? But I think just if you can accept where you're at now, and then just try and accept yourself, other people, and reality at large as much as possible. And the funny thing is, I would say, is acceptance isn't something you do. It's what you stop doing, which comes back to your tweet earlier. It's not resisting. Because people talk about accepting as a doing. It's like, no, the mind, thoughts resist, awareness is inherently accepting. So if you can stand as the aware mind, then, you know, acceptance isn't something you do, it's something you stop doing. So accept where you're at and just lean into that, I would say.
In the last minute of this podcast, dropping absolute nuggets. Incredible. I've never thought about acceptance from that perspective before. So thank you so much. And like I said, you're truly welcome on this podcast anytime. I'm looking forward to part two. I'm expecting it to be in Austin, Texas. It might be in the UK, but I am manifesting that and putting that in our future. That
Danny,
is now.
It's been such a pleasure. It's so nice to connect with you. As you said, I think just being able to pick straight up and feel like brothers from across the pond it's a beautiful thing, and it speaks to the importance and the power of this recognition. So just thanks for having me on. It's been lovely talking. It really has. What could be more fun than having conversations like this?
So special.